I thank you, first of all, for extending this very generous invitation to me. I am indeed delighted to appear for the first time in my life in a seminar. This is indeed a great honor to a layman. The subject of the morning's lecture is Luther's view of man in his early German writings. When Luther's first essay, Die Siebenbußpsalmen, Seven Penitential Psalms, appeared in the spring of 1517, it met with instantaneous success. The reception accorded the German works of the next few years was similarly, even increasingly enthusiastic. Martin Luther was, from his initial literary venture, easily the most widely read and influential writer in the German language in the second decade of the 16th century, from 1517 on to be exact, if we ignore a brief but very profound introduction to his first important edition of the Theologia Germanica of the year before, 1516. The author of approximately 30 significant treatises in the vernacular between 1517 and 1520 was the favorite of the German reading public, a distinction that was to remain his for many years to come. In this lecture, we must restrict ourselves to the first 4 or 5 years of Luther's literary activity in the language of the people. What was it that seemed to have caught the popular fancy? It could not have been the style, certainly not in 1517 and 1518. The German in the first 2 or 3 years of Luther's writing is awkward. The man who was soon to emerge as one of the greatest masters of the German tongue, if not indeed its greatest master, was still in the first stages of trying his wings. The power, the irony, and the sheer brilliance so evident in his works after 1520 or even 1519 are still lacking in the first of pieces, though there are passages here and there which seem to point in the direction of the later supreme mastery. Yet it was these laboring, heavy-handed early efforts to express what he had to say that won him a very large reading public immediately upon the publication of everything that came from his pen. I am persuaded it must have been the ideas young Luther had to propose that gained him his extensive audience. It was primarily what the man had to tell and not how he talked that compelled the intensive interest of his first reader. If one examines fairly closely all of Luther's early writings, one finds that, despite their amazing diversity and variety of subject matter, they are fundamentally unified and definitely oriented in one and the same direction. They have but one goal. Luther himself recognized this noteworthy fact when he confessed in the celebrated passage toward the end of Seven Penitential Psalms, that he was indeed playing on but one string and singing but one melody. Nicht mehr dann auf einer Seite lüren und nur ein Liedlein singen. It was essentially a single message, vigorously and relentlessly presented, that it took instant possession of the head and heart of his vast body. A readily discernible thread runs through all his early, and for that matter later, writings, a basic approach to life that even a casual reader could not miss. And there shouldn't be any casual readers of Luther in first place. In order to see Luther's immense success in a larger perspective, We should be fully aware that the young Augustinian's voice was definitely not the voice of one crying in the wilderness. One should never forget that there were many writers on religion and morality in the late 15th and early 16th centuries. Genuine interest in matters religious ran high. This was reflected in the enormous amount of religious literature available in German throughout the land. The humanist Sebastian Brandt has it this way in his famous Narrenschiff, the Ship of Fools, again of recent fame, as you may know, of 1494. All Land sind jetzt voll heiliger Geschrift, und was der Seelenheil antrifft, Bibel, der heiligen Väterlehr, und ander dergleich Bücher mehr. Whatever else may be said about what was in large measure little more than Gebrauchsliteratur, Sebastian Brandt, for one, was sure it did not really lead to amendment of life. There was no dearth of it in the decades before the Reformation. What was young Luther's place in this maelstrom of religious publication? Since he was manifestly listened to in the confusion of the many voices clamoring for attention, it is rather safe to assume that he must somehow have impressed the people as speaking with more authority than his rivals. And rivals there were many. There must have been, from the start, an unmistakable individuality about this man, something that set him apart from the rest of the writing guild. If readers flocked to him in ever-increasing numbers, it was because he had things to say they did not hear elsewhere, and things that proved to be singularly meaningful to them. From the mass of the religious literature of the early 16th century, Luther visibly stood out by the immediate success of every line he wrote. Though his first attempts in the vernacular were scarcely literary masterpieces, they were permeated with the ardor of a powerful personality, straining every nerve to deliver himself of the vital message. There was an infectious inevitability about the man and his persuasive words. No reader of the early German works can fail to be swept off his feet by the involvement of the author, by the engagement of the author. Every line he writes is a quiver with the excitement of a profound experience for which he's trying to find adequate words. The writer of these successful essays was evidently fulfilling the Nietzschean requirement for truly effective communication. And I believe, ever since I heard Paul Scherer at the Yale Divinity School delivering the Lyman Beecher lecture series, in which he said that no theologian is worth his salt who has not come to terms with Nietzsche, I feel I may mention it in this place. Nietzsche writes, then, here's the prescription for truly effective communication. Von allem Geschriebenen liebe ich nur das, was einer mit seinem Blute schreibt. What was young Luther writing about? In blood. His chief topic is the Christian religion. Every word he wrote about it shows that he endeavored to appropriate it with his whole mind. But in the very process of entering into his Christian heritage, he made a startling discovery. What his contemporaries called Christianity was not Christianity at all, as he saw it. Luther had actually known this for several years before the publication of his first work in the spring of 1517, almost 6 months before the epoch-making 95 theses. But before that year of decision, he had presented this electrifying matter only to his fellow monks and students in the relative safety of the traditional Latin. Early in 1517, he took the fateful step of moving his case out of monastic halls and academic halls, out of monastic walls and academic halls, into the much wider arena of the German reading lay public. Here was an author, excited and exciting, who was trying to put into idiomatic German what he had so far expressed only in the language of medieval scholars. These early German pages are alive with meaning, whatever their relative linguistic inadequacy. It is the substance that matters in these first essays of what is still Germany's mightiest writer. There is sorrow, disappointment, anger in his voice. There's also determination that things must improve. Luther is profoundly disturbed because something has happened to the religion of his father, something extremely serious. His shocking charge is that Christianity has lost its identity and surrendered its genes. Perhaps one can express Luther's feelings best by slightly changing a famous passage from Goethe's Faust. Die ihm das Leben gaben, herrliche Gefühle, erstarrten in den irdischen Gewühle. The fiery young professor is persuaded that the church of his day is out of joint. He's equally persuaded, after much travail of soul, that he was born to set it right. But unlike Hamlet, he did not really complain about the gigantic attack before him. On the contrary, once he had fully realized the inevitability of the tremendous struggle, he undertook it resolutely with faith in the rightness of his cause. This irreversible decision to go ahead gives every word its unmistakable Lutheran ring. Luther is infinitely troubled by the Christian idea of man that seemed to prevail in his time. He found it wanting in depth. Worse than that, he thought it was no longer a Christian at all. What he saw in the world about him was an idea of man that was apparently a compromise between theology and philosophy. This confusion he would not tolerate. He was sure it was to blame for many of the ills of the church. A restoration of a thoroughly a Christian view of man was desperately needed. With this analysis of the basic crisis in the church, it is hardly surprising that the idea of man should loom so large in his early German writing. How does Lutheran man differ from late medieval Roman Catholic man? That is the basic question of Luther's early essay. To give a succinct preliminary answer, Lutheran man rigorously eliminates every substantial accretion to Pauline man that the centuries between Paul and Luther has permitted to occur. What young Luther insists on again and again is what his generation, or any generation for that matter, is ever so reluctant to hear: man's thoroughgoing sinfulness. Although post-Pauline and pre-Lutheran Christianity never completely abandoned this disturbingly harsh view of man, it did allow some claims to some human dignity before God, but to dilute the austere Pauline picture of the sinful nature of man. It is against this progressive weakening of Paul's severe concept that young Luther protests with a passionate vigor. Anything less than the full measure of Paul's analysis of the human situation will not do for Luther. Only the Pauline approach satisfies. There is something deeply moving about the personal intensity with which Luther defends Paul and attacks the contemporary theological thought and, of course, religious practice, although the latter in spite of the popular picture of Luther, is not really what matters. That almost anybody else with the power could have achieved, but not the theological lesson. Luther takes extraordinary pains to tell his readers why, against the spirit of the times, he subscribes to the uncomfortable view held by Paul. There's an astonishingly high degree of elective affinity between the two men, with Luther fully appropriating the relevant thinking of his chief master in matters religious. A close reading of Luther shows that his agreement with Paul is not merely based on the external authority of this greatest single figure in the Christian tradition, of this greatest single human figure, of course, in the Christian tradition. The impression is inescapable that Paul's deepest insight struck home with Luther. There's something almost predestined about the meeting of these two minds. One is reminded of Goethe's first acquaintance with Shakespeare, or of Nietzsche's first reading of Schopenhauer and hearing Wagner. Small wonder that Luther, in his earliest writings, with their less than a perfect mastery of German, is most eloquent when he portrays human thinking. It is very important to understand fully what Luther means by thinking. If we fail to grasp his literally staggering idea of thinking, we will never do justice to the genius of Luther or fathom his profundity. It can scarcely be stated too emphatically or repeated too often that young Luther does not inveigh primarily against obvious transgressions of the Ten Commandments. He is concerned with a much deeper layer of the human personality. It goes without saying that he expressed his extreme displeasure with gross sin as a matter of course. It is equally true that he does not dwell on it at great length. Everybody else does. There is no compelling reason why Luther, occupied with much more subtle things, should merely add one more voice to the universal disapproval of sin in the clearly visible manifestation. His was the searching mind which penetrated to regions not accessible to most writers of his or any age. Sin, then, as normally understood, is definitely not Luther's chief topic in his analysis of the human situation. What usually passes for sin is altogether too superficial an interpretation of the main fact of life on the Lutheran level, an all-pervasive sense of human inadequacy in the sight of God. Anything short of this shattering experience is branded by Luther as either a pre-Christian or extra-Christian. He is a Christian thinker determined to live on the heights and in the depths of what Paul has taught him to look upon as genuine Christian insight into the nature of man. Luther will not budge an inch from this hard-won position. The word of compromise does not exist in his vocabulary. Having wrestled with the idea of sin as few men ever have, he makes his readers feel on every page that he knows exactly what he is talking about. Unsettling and disturbing as his picture of man is, it is set forth with disarming power and winsome persuasiveness. Luther has his readers hanging on his lips. As he relentlessly presents the matter, sin runs deep in human life. It reaches into the most hidden recesses. If you take, for example, Luther's early interpretation of the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." For Luther, its meaning is in no way exhausted by the explicit injunction to abstain from the taking human life. So far as I can see, he goes even beyond the extension of its scope in the Sermon on the Mount. He is not willing to let things go even at the level of avoiding anger with one's brother. Luther is not primarily concerned with the thou shalt not aspect of the commandment. He insists that man, especially a Christian man, rise to a far-reaching positive interpretation of all its implications. The essence of this commandment, he argues, is made if one remains within the merely preventive and negative area of its applicability. For Luther, the assumption is that decent human beings, whether Christians or not, do not resort to murder in the first place. The substance of this commandment for him is rather a voluntary, even joyous, aiding of others. It is basic to a real understanding of Luther's thought that the words voluntary and joyous are taken at their face value. Just helping one's neighbor is not enough. Coram Deo. This help must not be grudgingly given. It must be utterly spontaneous and freely offered from a heart overflowing with altruism and generosity. Anything short of this inner attitude is unacceptable in the sight of God. As Luther sees it, all those who do not fully, and that in this case means 100%, measure up to this high standard of excellence are breaking this command. In his eyes, it is a grievous sin to fail to live up to this indispensable requirement of utterly voluntary, eager help extended to others. Luther insists on gründliches Ganzmut as a necessary inner attitude. Da jammert das Herz alles Übels, was seinem Feind widerfährt. Only those who aspire to these heights of behavior are recognized by him as die rechtene Kind und Erb Gottes und Bruder Christi, der für uns alle also getan hat an dem Heiligen Kreuz. This single example must suffice to suggest what young Luther means by sin. It is never a question of adhering to the letter of the law. The commandment must be richly and generously interpreted. Beyond refraining from murder, a true Christian is expected by Luther to live up to any and all of the positive implications with a cheerful heart, an eager heart, to rush to the help of others. Luther was the first to grant with infinite sadness that no man is able to fulfill this or any other commandment thus interpreted. In his first major essay of the great year, 1520, Von den guten Werken, on good works, Luther discusses all the commandments in the same searching manner. Unless all possible positive implications of all the commandments are fulfilled with gladness and perfect eagerness, man is a sinner before God, even if he may succeed in impressing his vastly less critical and vastly less perceptive fellow men with his apparent goodness. What matters is the judgment of God and not that of man. That is young Luther's immutable view. It is hard to deny that Luther's idea of sin is profound. But as every student of the Reformation knows, so are all aspects of his prodigious theology. The more closely one reads his work, the superb Latin lectures, as well as the challenging German essays, the more one is impressed with the essential rightness of his claim, but nothing less than his inexorable analysis of the human situation before God will do justice to the peculiar genius of Christianity. It is of crucial importance to realize that young Luther was sure that no other religion or philosophy he knew anything about had as profound a concept of sin as Christianity. That was one of the major reasons why Luther stuck to it as tenaciously as he did. He had examined non-Christian Jews and found them wanting. He was not really surprised at that. But he was shocked no end and deeply hurt that the church of his day appeared to have given up its distinguishing heritage. What he could not brook under any circumstances was that Christianity was no longer concerned with what he took to be ultimate insight. He thought he had observed at close range that the very core of the Christian religion had been surrendered in favor of a reintroduction of pre- and extra-Christian standards. With all his might, he hurled himself against the leveling out of process he was witnessing all around him. He was determined to undo the fearful damage done to what he held dearer than life itself. Men must again take sin seriously. After reading Martin Luther, many in the 16th century did. That's why you are here, I believe. Those who listened well to his analysis of their real condition were soon begging and crying for help. What should they do in their plight? What does a Christian man, specifically Lutheran man, do in the most uncomfortable situation in which Luther has placed him? Stern young Luther had his leaders where he wanted them. He had them where he himself had been a few years earlier. He wanted them to realize that the divine law, as interpreted by Paul and himself, demanded the impossible from them. Again, you may quote from the second part of Faust, Dem lieb ich der Unmögliches begehrt. He wanted them to endeavor to live up to the law and to fail as he had failed after trying as hard as anyone ever had. Luther was more than ready by this time to show them the way out of their predicament. But in order for them to appreciate fully the incredible solution of their problem, he first wanted them to see that there was a problem, and that their problem was infinitely more serious than they had been led to think by the church of their time. It will always be a moving experience to read young Luther's dramatic presentation of the way out of the immense difficulty in which man, according to him, finds himself. The sternness and sadness of Luther the moralist yields to the exaltation and rapture of Luther the evangelist. Luther is literally overwhelmed by the mercy of God. The reader feels that Luther is shaken. Luther is stirred beyond words that it was God who took the initiative in man's so precarious situation. And he marvels day and night at God's decision to help helpless man. Young Luther thought he could never fully exhaust this greatest of miracles. He was not so much concerned with the miracles of the gospel. That was something he thought was a secondary significance. The great miracle was the incarnation. If young Luther thought he could never exhaust this greatest of miracles, the old Luther was still trying to grasp the central fact of the divine-human encounter. God's intervention meant that man had to accept the divine hand so graciously extended. But this seemingly simple fact is beset with extraordinary difficulties for man. It is simple only on the surface and in theory. In reality, it is one of the most difficult things, so difficult, in fact, that man cannot take advantage of the divine offer under his own power. Accepting the outstretched hand of God is impossible without divine grace. Young Luther tried valiantly to make this rock-bottom experience crystal clear to his readers
And I believe he succeeded, if only you began to read Luther. Thus Luther's amazingly profound sense of sin was accompanied by an equally profound apprehension and appreciation of divine grace.